Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 Joycast. In this Joycast, you'll hear a summary of the weekly program. Due to copyright restrictions, the music has been edited to make this Joycast possible. For more information about the music played during the show, please visit the blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera.
Good evening and welcome to The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. I'm Paul Williamson and I'm your summer host, sitting in for Dan Vo for the month of January. And I'm here with my guest this evening, the charming Rebecca Bywater, who is a member of the Victorian Opera Chorus. Rebecca, welcome to Joy 94.9.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Now we're going to explore what it means to be a member of an opera chorus and what part the chorus plays in opera. But to begin, let's find out a little bit about our guest. Now, Rebecca, you've been a member of the VO Chorus since its inception in 2006, so you're a foundation member. Can you tell us a little bit about when you first started singing and why?
Yes, I can. I started singing as a young girl in primary school, and I've always sung, but I got into our church choir and school choirs quite early on. So I've always had a long association doing choral and operatic works. So that's kind of how I got into it.
Okay, and I think you went to school in Tasmania, didn't you?
Yes, I did, on the northwest coast, just as you did, I think.
Just as I did. You were in Devonport and I was in Smithton.
That's right.
Yes.
Northwest coasters.
Now, what attracted you to using your voice as a musical instrument?
Well, I first started out learning the piano,
yeah.
As most young kids did on the northwest coast. I have to say that was what the option was. Tasmania has a lot of pianos. So I started learning the piano and realised that I didn't have the discipline or diligence really to become a concert pianist. Practising 6 hours a day was a bit too much for me, and you can practise much less as a singer. So I found myself naturally falling and aligning myself more with the singing discipline rather than piano.
Excellent. And when did you first become interested in singing opera? Was that your initial goal, or did you perhaps have your eye on being a jazz singer or a blues singer or even a pop singer?
Well, when I started my first year of university at the University of Tasmania Conservatorium of Music in Hobart in 96, that's when I really became exposed to the more higher genres, if you will, of things like opera. So that's when I really first got started. And leading up to that, I was involved in the high school musical, and of course I was completely inspired by the music theatre world and
what
that sort of thing.
What musicals did you perform?
I starred in Godspell.
Oh.
With the Don College, which must have been in 94 or 95, and other kind of concert versions and you know, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, etc. experiences, which were totally out of my league for that time.
Old Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Yes, at the Devonport Sound Shell. But it was most enjoyable, and it really did inspire real passion and enjoyment for singing as an art form.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really where I first started. But I also aspired to be a cabaret artist. I sung a lot of Weimar-era cabaret songs and Piaf songs in my university days.
A la Robin Archer.
And I even met her.
Wow.
Yes, she was wearing a very odd outfit, but that doesn't really matter right now. She was doing Carnival of the Animals, and she was wearing a very theatrical kind of jungle number, which didn't suit, but that's okay. But yes, the cabaret thing was such an inspiration and important thing for me that I actually did my master's on the interpretation of cabaret.
Wow. This is in Hobart.
Yes, in Hobart. Mm-hmm. So, but that all aside, I had to make a decision at some stage because the opposing vocal techniques of doing music theatre or contemporary singing and operatic singing are not aligned in the slightest, and they actually work against each other. Yes. So I had to make a decision.
So, and how did you make that decision?
Well, it was a funny one to make because I wasn't as good an opera singer as I was singing cabaret, but the passion and the delight in the music and the complexity that opera offers that I have to say the cabaret didn't offer for me. So that's why I really pursued it. And it's one of those things that you'll never understand the full repertoire or get to hear everything. And I think that was what was quite exciting for me.
And that was a decision you made in Tasmania before you came to the mainland?
The mainland, the bigger island. Yes, it was. It was a really conscious decision that, no, I'm not going to pursue this. I'm going to pursue opera as a career.
Excellent. Okay, now, Rebecca, I have asked you to bring in some tracks, and in particular chorus tracks, because you're a chorus member. So what is your first selection, and why have you chosen it?
The first selection I have is from Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, and it's the final chorus number, and that's called With Drooping Wings. And I chose this because it was my first chorus and operatic experience at university, and it really was life-changing. In my view, it's an exquisite chamber opera, and it's still my very favourite opera to this day. And I think it has it all. It's got the drama of the sorceress and the witches and all the fun of that, and then the great lament, the very famous lament,
yes,
that Dido sings at the very end. And this is the final chorus, which it's nice that the chorus gets the last say, I have to say.
Okay, let's hear With Drooping Wings from Dido and Aeneas. You're on The Fool and the Opera. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. I'm Paul Williamson, and we just heard With Drooping Wings from Purcell's opera Dido and Aeneas, the very favourite opera of my guest this evening, Rebecca Bywater, who is a member of the Victorian Opera Chorus. That was a beautiful track, Rebecca.
Yes, it really has a special place for me.
Right back to your student days. Now, Rebecca, your voice is described as a mezzo-soprano, and there aren't very many starring roles for mezzos. What are a few of the key opera roles for the mezzo voice?
Well, the most obvious one is Bizet's Carmen, the title yes. role of Carmen, which is a very famous opera. And the other starring roles are really in the Rossini repertoire, where you have countless mezzo heroines, if you like. But they're fast being populated by sopranos.
Yes, yes. I was interested to see on that Dido and Aeneas that we just played, the Dido is actually sung by the mezzo Susan Graham. Mm. And that's one role that's often taken over by the sopranos, isn't it?
That's right. But it depends on the voice type and what the musical director is really going for in voice type selection. But, yeah, so when I was in Paris last year, I went to see Maria Bayo sang Rosina, Barbara of Seville. And yes, she was excellent and the pyrotechnics were wonderful and everything, but she's a soprano. Mm-hmm. And I really had my heart singing on a really good mezzo in that role. But it's not all bad, but it's just very interesting that that seems to be the almost lighter voice type that people are going for.
Mm, mm. Now, you mentioned that Dido and Aeneas. Was that your first role?
Not. It was my first opera in terms of being in a chorus. My first role was as the monitor in Suor Angelica.
Oh, wow.
Puccini.
So this is back at the Tasmanian Con?
This is at the Con in Hobart. And my best friend Gina was the title role, and I was her monitor. And kind of an abbess role, a mother abbess role. And it was such a wonderful role for a young singer, and for any singer really, to stretch their legs a bit and see what they can do. And singing Puccini, one of the greats, it was an amazing work, and it was a really amazing creative experience to be part of.
Yes, Puccini is a wonderful composer indeed. Now, what are some of the other opera companies that you've sung with before joining Victorian Opera, and what are some of the roles that you've sung there?
Well, I've performed with the Lyric Opera of Melbourne and also Melbourne Opera in a variety of settings, Don Giovanni and those sort of works. But
have you had a solo part?
No, because they haven't really had anything with a mezzo role. It's actually been not for trying, but for lack of opportunity, I think. I've had a lot of luck doing solos in oratorio and other concert settings, but the mezzo roles are just not abound. And when Sally Ann Russell's in town, I don't think people are going to be knocking on my door, Paul.
Oh, well.
Maybe one day, but not at this stage. She's doing extremely well.
She is indeed. So you joined Victorian Opera in 2006.
That's right.
At its inception.
Mm-hmm.
So what works have you performed with Victorian Opera?
I've done all the gala concerts, and I've also done Gluck's Orpheus and Eurydice, and Donizetti's Elixir of Love.
Now you had two leading tenors in that, as I recall, David Hobson and Roy Best.
Yes, that was really interestingly cast, if I may say. We have something in the opera world called an A cast and a B cast,
yes.
And I don't know if that will make sense to any of you, but it's about the A cast is considered star cast, and
yes.
B cast is considered supporting, and to basically keep the season going over, say, 13 nights or something where the leading tenor might tire. But I think we had just as good a B cast as an A cast in this instance.
Yes.
David Hobson and Antoinette Halloran, the A cast, and Roy Best, who's just charming and really come on from Opportunity Oz, which is where he was discovered, and Eleanor Xanthadakis. And for me, I actually preferred the B cast.
All right, let's go to your second music selection. What have we got here, Rebecca?
Well, we're jumping back to Puccini's Suor Angelica, all those years ago, dressed up as a nun, a lot of fun. And it's the finale when Suor Angelica, Sister Angelica, realises that to commit suicide and drink poison is a mortal sin. And oops, how's she going to get out of that one? Well, she doesn't, but she does pray to God and is forgiven and absolved in the end. So all ends very nicely.
Excellent. Let's go to the finale from Suor Angelica by Puccini. You're on The Fool and the Opera. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. I'm Paul Williamson, and we just heard the finale of Suor Angelica, which is the second opera in Puccini's trio of operas called Il Trittico, and the soprano there was Miriam Gaucci. Wow, Rebecca, another interesting track.
Yes, it's quite beautiful, and that sustained high note at the end is very majestic. But it's just a beautiful, again, a chamber opera work that is so easily performed but rarely performed.
Yes.
It's rarely performed as part of the group of three, but it's a very beautiful
opera
piece.
Opera Australia does have a production of Il Trittico, which I think it's actually the oldest production in their repertoire. I think it dates from about 1969 or something.
Well, it'd be an enormous task to revise it.
Yes, yes, it would be. And I saw Cheryl Barker in that role a couple of years ago in Sydney. But it hasn't been to Melbourne for quite some time. Yeah. Now, Rebecca, let's now focus on the role of the chorus in opera. The word chorus derives from the Greek word choros, which meant a festive dance or those who performed it. Can you tell us briefly how this has evolved in the operatic tradition to come to mean that group of singers who are either integral to the action or who act as commentators on the action, which is occurring amongst the principal singers?
Yes, of course. The Florentine Camerata, who were the group of 17th century musicians, poets and artists, renewed musical practices associated with ancient Greek drama. And they realised that choruses should not simply be decorative, but should also commentate on and participate in the action. Early opera composers such as Monteverdi and Lully both used choruses in their operas, not only as commentators, but also to provide context and structure to the overall musical work. And composers like Handel cemented the use of choruses in operas and also in oratorios, the great oratorios like The Messiah. And there has been a place for choruses in operas ever since, which is excellent news for someone like me.
I know Richard Gill, who's the artistic director of Victorian Opera, is a big fan of Monteverdi, isn't he?
Yes, as am I, and the other ensemble I sing with, E21, Ensemble 21, directed by Stephen Grant. We do a lot of Monteverdi performances, and we did something with Ludovico's band at Sydney Opera House last year, Monteverdi's Ninth Book of Madrigals, which is quite an interesting performance of it, actually. It was staged, cantatas
really?
And things.
Yeah. Wow.
So it was operatic-like, if you will.
Okay. Mm. And was it a success?
Oh, it was a great success. It was something that we've got a bit of a tour, actually. We've performed it in Castlemaine and Ballarat, Melbourne, and now Sydney. Where else could we go?
Fabulous.
Straight to the Met, I think.
Now, what is the rehearsal process for the chorus? At what point does the chorus come in and the soloists to get together in the rehearsal process?
Yes, well, normally for one of the big productions, we have a 6 week or so rehearsal period, and it takes a while for us to, we kind of work in parallel processes. So the soloists are working with the musical director to learn their parts, work on interpretation and language and other sort of things. And the chorus at the same time is concurrently working on their part in the opera, the language, blending, all those things you need to do when a group of people get together to make sure they're doing similar things. And that musical preparation and the memorisation of that actually has to be bedded down quite quickly if you're working for a 6 week lead up for a show. So after that, we move to the blocking stage where the director works hands on with us to get us learning the moves, or the choreographer. And it's at that point that the soloists and the chorus really get together, but only in the scenes where the soloists are involved with the chorus.
Yes.
Often we, as the chorus members, don't actually see most of the opera until the stage and dress rehearsal period, and we're usually hanging out in the wings to see all the intricacies and how it's been realised, because we just don't get to see that part of the rehearsal process at times.
How many members are there of the Victorian Opera Chorus?
There are 60 members that sing in the larger gala concert works, but there's a core kind of group of around, usually about three to a part, so I'll have to figure that out, 12. 12 of us.
Four tenors.
Yes.
sorry, three tenors, three basses,
yes.
three mezzos and three sopranos.
That's right. And, yes, we worked together on the smaller roles, like the smaller operas like the Orfeo and things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's very enjoyable working with a small group. It can be unwieldy with the large numbers.
Yes,
too
yes.
many people to talk to at break time. And singers like to talk.
I bet, I bet. Okay, let's move on to your third choice of music. What have you got here? And can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, of course. The third choice is something that you will probably know very well. It's one of Verdi's great works, Nabucco, and Va Pensiero,
oh,
the
yes.
chorus of the Hebrew slaves.
Yes, yes.
And it's probably one of the best known and loved choruses that you could ever hear. And it's certainly something that I think audiences enjoy just as much as the chorus enjoys singing.
There's a wonderful story about this chorus. When Verdi died and his body was being carried through the streets of Milan, the people in the street spontaneously broke in to the chorus and just began to sing it.
Isn't that delightful?
I think that's an amazing story and just shows what the high regard that the people of Milan held for Verdi.
Mm.
Yeah, amazing. All right, let's go to Va Pensiero, the Hebrews chorus from Verdi's Nabucco. You're on The Fool and the Opera. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. I'm Paul Williamson, and I'm talking with the lovely Rebecca Bywater, a foundation member of the Victorian Opera Chorus. And Rebecca's third music selection was the Hebrew Slaves Chorus, Va Pensiero, from Verdi's Nabucco. And that was Verdi's first big hit as a composer. Okay, Rebecca, do you think the creation of the Victorian Opera Company has been good for opera in Melbourne and Victoria? And what do you think it has added to the opera scene that maybe we didn't have previously?
I think it's been enormously beneficial for the singers, the musicians and everyone involved with the company and also the audiences, I very much hope. The thing that was kind of missing, there was a big gap after the Victorian State Opera collapsed or closed. I don't know how you would kind of refer to that.
It was sort of swallowed up by Opera Australia.
Yes, there was but it wasn't pleasant. But there was certainly a gap that was left and it was waiting to be filled by another professional company. It was only a matter of time before the state government or someone would get behind some sort of initiative. So it's been a really good thing for the city and for the state to have a professional up and running company again.
Mm. And it seems to be hitting top gear this year with its season, but we'll get to that later.
Mm.
My next question is, who are some of the big opera stars that you've shared the stage with?
Mm-hmm.
You've already mentioned David Hobson and Roy Best and Antoinette Halloran. And are they all prima donnas in the truly operatic style, or are they a bit more down to earth than that?
Well, prima donnas is an interesting thing. It depends really on what the review was like, whether you see some antics when people didn't get a good review. Nobody knows where to look in the chorus, but that's okay. Yes, well, I've also sung with Rosamund Dilling,
mm-hmm.
who's a senior lecturer in voice at the University of Melbourne,
yes,
as well.
And a very celebrated soprano.
Extremely celebrated mm-hmm. soprano. And she's a wonderful performer and just
yes.
a joy to be on stage with and see her in full flight. And also Tyrone Landau, who
oh, yes.
you may know Tyrone, who's now in London.
Is he a countertenor?
Well, that's a very interesting question because he often is seen to be doing the countertenor role in Carmina Burana.
Yes.
And I actually asked him that question when he was doing it. He did it for the University of Tasmania in Hobart several years ago. And I said, are you a countertenor? And he said, no, but I think I'm the only tenor who's stupid enough to sing this. So I think he knew that it was rather peculiar. But we've also sung with him in a combattimento of Tancredi and Clorinda Monteverdi last year, and he's extremely interesting, but if I may say, slightly peculiar. And I think that's kind of a running theme of the big stars that you sing with. They have got something really special about them, and that can often mean that they're not the most predictable people to work with, or the best well-centered people, if that makes sense.
I think that makes sense. I think, you know, the artistic people often have, I don't know, little idiosyncrasies, say.
Yes, I think that's a fair comment.
I think that's a fair comment. You've talked about some performers there. Are there any other opera singers who stand out for you and go wider than people you've worked with here in terms of their singing and performing or even in terms of their offstage antics?
You're really trying to draw something out of me here, Paul, I can tell. Well, you know, I've never understood Sumi Jo. Let's just put it out there. What happened with her in Sydney? Didn't she nick off?
She left very abruptly, I believe, yes.
She nicked off before a final performance,
yes.
And they had her back.
Yes.
That's what I was actually surprised about. I would have assumed that you would have got into trouble and be off the books after that. But they must love her there.
Well, she's very talented.
Well, I'll give her that. She's a little pocket rocket. She was actually practicing in one of the practice rooms at the college when they didn't have a place to practice. And I was lucky enough to be strolling on by. And it's a bigger voice than you might expect.
Yes.
Coloratura soprano in full flight makes a decent sound.
Certainly does. I know that because I was sitting in the front row when Emma Matthews performed with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra last year.
How lovely. That would have been a good concert.
It was a very good concert. Mm. Yeah, excellent, excellent. Mm. All right, let's go to your fourth musical choice, Rebecca. What have we got next?
The next choice is technically not an opera, but I'll explain more. It's Karl Orff's Carmina Burana, two of the final tracks from that work, final pieces rather. It's technically a stage cantata, it's called, this work.
What is a staged cantata?
Well, it's a few pieces of music strung together, but not staged, essentially. But it's like it's staged. It's secular music, this. It's so it couldn't really be called an oratorio. It's not sacred. But he was kind of very... This was a real coming of age for him, devising this work. And it is the best way in to classical music, if you ask me. Yep. It's exciting. It's wonderful to listen to. I think people, the connoisseurs, might find it a bit tacky, but it's great fun to perform.
Yes.
And it should be performed by an operatic chorus. You
yes.
need that kind of those kind of forces.
And you did perform it, is it a couple of years ago now?
It was February last year, actually.
Oh,
February 2009,
one.
Just a year ago.
Gosh.
Paul, time's going fast.
It certainly is.
But yes, it was a wonderful experience with our very own Orchestra Victoria performing that, and I was a couple of rows behind the percussion section. There's eight of them and doing all kinds of things. It was very loud, but very enjoyable.
Okay, let's go to Karl Orff's Carmina Burana, the last two pieces. You're on The Fool and the Opera. You're on The Fall and the Opera on Joy 94.9. I'm Paul Williamson, and we just heard the finale to Karl Orff's Carmina Burana, a staged cantata, not an opera. And the finale is called O Fortuna. And that was the fourth selection of my special guest today, Rebecca Bywater from the Victorian Opera Chorus. Now, Rebecca, you also have a full-time day job at the School of Music at the Victorian College of the Arts and Music.
Yes, that's right.
How do you go about juggling the demands of your day job with your opera gigs?
Well, it can be a challenge at times, but thankfully I have a very understanding boss who knows that singing is extremely important to me and trumps work most of the time. So we're very fortunate that the chorus calls are usually in the evenings, but every now and then we will have day calls, so I will be required to nick off from work for a little while, and that's fine. But I suppose the really big issue for me to juggle is the very long days when I'm working all day and then going into the evening to do the rehearsals, which can be very difficult and can be very difficult for my husband and my cat, who live without me for a little while. But it's only usually in 6 week blocks, so it's intensive periods of really intensive work, and then kind of settles down a bit. So in terms of juggling that, it can be a challenge, but it's not impossible.
So have you got, apart from having a supportive husband and mm-hmm. a supportive cat, mm-hmm. have you got any tips for you know, how you cope with those long days?
Well, it's the timing of the coffee breaks, I think, is very important. And also giving yourself an opportunity to get in the fresh air. And I'm an early bird. I start at 7 o'clock. I start work, and that's my prime time for getting things done. And then, you know, if you end up slacking off a bit in the afternoon and falling over, at least you've done most of the work. So it's not going to be the end of the world.
Now, what plans do you have for your own singing career? I'm guessing you're aspiring to do some more solo work. Mm-hmm. So what roles would you like to do, and where would you like to go over the next 4 or 5 years, say?
Well, that's a good question, because it's one that a singer has to ask herself or himself constantly, is, well, where am I going with this? And it's very easy to find yourself falling into a rut of, well, this is what I do, I sing in the chorus. And if you want to do something a bit more special and beyond that, you need to seek out those opportunities. And I'd be very interested in doing some small roles with a few of the local companies, perhaps Victorian Opera, but it's always very dependent on the actual works, that the season and who might else be around. But if I was to do that, I'd have to put in a serious year of work this year, because my job has kind of bubbled over into the rest of my life and become a little bit consuming. So New Year's resolution, it's a good time to be thinking about those things, but it's about giving yourself space to do the things that you really want to do in life.
Absolutely. Mm. Now, speaking of Victorian Opera's year ahead, I'm just going to rattle through the program, because it's quite, I think, a very varied and courageous season in some respects. There's the concert version of Berlioz's Damnation of Faust. There's a double bill, which is William Walton's The Bear and Jacques Ibert's Angelique. Then we've got Kurt Weill's Threepenny Opera, Benjamin Britten's Turn of the Screw, Handel's Julius Caesar, and two new commissioned works, The Parrot Factory and The Cockatoos. So which of these ones include a chorus, and which ones are you most looking forward to?
Oh, well, a bit unfortunately, actually, there's only one chorus gig this year. And well, kind of. It's the Damnation of Faust, and there's also an Opera Bowl concert that's coming up that we're doing, I think, with the MSO in next month.
Yes.
Where we all get to get in our frocks, which will be very nice.
Do you get your frock?
Oh, well, most people go to Linda Britten or Mariana Hardwick, and I think I'm due for a new Mariana Hardwick.
Okay.
So let's just see. I'll splash
let's
it out.
Lash
out. Yeah, why not? I think something in red. Anyway, but yes, Damnation of Faust is the only other chorus kind of event.
And that's just a
this
one-off,
year.
Isn't it?
Yes, it is. But there's always a few more things that come up during the year. We usually do something in the Melbourne Festival as well. So there'll be other things. It's just in the actual concert series, that's all that's coming up, really. But in terms of the season, there's going to be some great things, and I'm particularly interested in Kurt Weill's Threepenny Opera, I have to say.
Yes, the casting for that is amazing. There's Eddie Perfect, Judy Connelly,
the Paul Capsis.
Dimity Shepherd.
Dimity will be wonderful in that,
so
too.
It's a pretty good cast. I'm very much looking forward to that. And you also mentioned countertenors earlier, and Julius Caesar contains two countertenor roles, and we've got David Hanson and Tobias Cole lining up. Yes, so that will be very interesting too.
Yeah, that's excellent casting. And it's, you know, there are a lot of ways you can go with these things as well. But choosing, just to go back to Threepenny Opera for a moment, choosing that sort of cast, especially Eddie Perfect as well, who's not really probably performed on an operatic stage before, but will be fantastic in that role.
Yes.
And that's very exciting. It's lovely to see that the company goes in a different sort of direction. It's a very boutique offering rather than the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do know a bit about William Walton. I did The Facade several years ago.
Yes.
And Barry Humphreys did that recently.
Yes.
Did you see that?
I did see that. Did you?
No, I didn't, and I don't know why. I think I had family coming at Christmas. I would love to have.
An unusual program. Barry Humphreys did some selections, his own personal selections in the first half, and then in the second half, Celeste Patterson came out, and followed by Dame Edna Everage. So it was Barry Humphreys in all his guises with the Australian Chamber Orchestra. So quite a unique concert, that
I think it would be.
All right, Rebecca, we're coming towards the end of our time this evening. What have we got for your fifth and final track?
Right, for the final track, this is perhaps gives you an idea of where I'd like to be heading, where I'd like to go. It's a solo piece, this one, sung by Cecilia Bartoli, who's, you know, the most famous mezzo in the world, I would assume.
She is. We actually did a program on the castrati
last
week's show, and we had a wonderful track that Cecilia performed at such breakneck speed that it was quite amazing how she can do it.
She certainly has the agility like no other singer I've heard. She's quite outstanding and completely adored by so many. But a lot of purists turn their noses up to her, like anyone, I suppose. People have people that are for and against.
I believe she hasn't got a particularly big voice in terms of when you put her into the opera house. Mm. I think she's more suited to the smaller venues.
And Mozart operas and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yes, well, I think to get such a big voice around the works that she's doing would be impossible. Your listeners will hear in the next piece the agility and the pyrotechnics that she's able to achieve. You can't achieve it with a massive, heavy, weighted voice. So the track I've chosen is the finale again from Cenerentola by Rossini. Cenerentola is the Cinderella story.
It is.
So it's just beautiful. And it's called Non Più Mesta. And it's when she comes together at the end of the opera with her with the prince and her father and her ugly stepsisters, and everyone's there, and she just sings this most glorious aria. And I think every mezzo deep down would love to sing this role.
Okay, with that introduction, let's go to Cecilia Bartoli singing Non Più Mesta from La Cenerentola. You're on The Fool and the Opera. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. I'm Paul Williamson, and we've just spent a fascinating 55 minutes or so with Rebecca Bywater, a member of the Victorian Opera Chorus. And that final track was the wonderful Cecilia Bartoli with Non Più Mesta, the finale of Rossini's Cenerentola. Rebecca, thank you very much indeed for coming in and giving up your time this evening, and for sharing your experiences with me. It's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure as well. Thank you so much for having me in.
Excellent. So that's about all the time we've got tonight. So as Rebecca Bywater might say, we'll see you next time. Same Fledermouse time, same Fledermouse channel. This has been The Fool and the Opera.
Thanks for listening to the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera from Joy 94.9. You can find more Joycasts and the program blog at joy.org.au facebook.com/The Fool and the Opera. The Fool and the Opera is produced by Dan Vo and Jed Gilbert, thanks to the support of Joy sponsors and members. Please help support it by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.